Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Dr. H.W. Brands. Dr. Brands holds the Jack S. Blanton Senior Chair in History at the University of Texas, an incredibly prolific author of American history and its most evocative and important periods. Dr. Brand has written 25 books, edited at least five others, and has published dozens of articles and scores of reviews. He's written in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the Atlantic, and many others. His latest work is Heirs of the Founders, the epic rivalry of Henry Clay, John Calhoun, and Daniel Webster, the second generation of American giants, published by Doubleday and just released. These three men, successors of our founding fathers, each born within 4 or 5 years of the American Revolution, through their rivalry and in some cases their similarities, helped to forge, for good or for bad, the conditions which led to our great Civil War. Each had aspirations for the presidency, each failed. However, Clay served as Speaker of the House and John Quincy Adams Secretary of State, forged the Missouri Compromise, which indeed was that, allowing one state to remain slave-free and the other to hold on to an unspeakable tradition. That alone is an issue that is fraught with questions and wonder, and I will ask those questions today. Calhoun was vice president to both John Quincy Adams and Andrew Jackson, essentially extolled slavery as the crown of the Southern culture. I wonder why he didn't become president just from sheer tenure, just as I wonder today about Joe Biden. And Webster, my favorite, I guess because of Stephen Vincent Benet's short story, The Devil and Daniel Webster, was a senator, secretary of state to three presidents and the most gifted courtroom advocate of the time, and maybe of any time, save for, say, Clarence Darrow. He abandoned his anti-slavery position in an attempt to wrest the presidency from his erstwhile rivals. Once again, much as Mitch McConnell and Charles Grassley have done today in their flip-flops on the absurd presidency of Donald Trump. In any event, and to stop my railing, Dr. Brand has, in an accessible and compelling narrative, woven the threads of the lives of these three men, the great triumvirate, and given us a good object lesson of the origins of constitutional crises and what they can lead to. Welcome, Dr. Brand, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Delighted to be with you.
So in capsule form, who were these three men?
They were the three great members of Congress of their era. Henry Clay was from Kentucky. He started out as a member of the House of Representatives. On his very first day in the House, he became Speaker of the House. John Calhoun was a congressman and then a senator from South Carolina. Daniel Webster was originally a congressman from New Hampshire, but he moved to Massachusetts and was a senator from Boston. So the three of them represented, respectively, Henry Clay, the West, John Calhoun, the South, Daniel Webster, the North.
How did their lives, especially in this time, politically at least, come together and having them butt heads most of the time?
In the golden age of congressional and American political oratory, these were the three most gifted speakers of all. One of the things that really impressed me about them and about the era was the extent to which political debates were actually conducted in public, in political speeches. Nowadays, people give political speeches, and if you go on C-SPAN, you can watch people giving political speeches, but if the camera ever pans away from the speaker, you'll see that they're speaking to an empty house. Decisions nowadays in Congress are made elsewhere. They're made in lobbying rooms, they're made in committee rooms, but they were actually made on the floor of the Senate and the House in those days. And when Henry Clay spoke on behalf of the Missouri Compromise, or the Compromise of 1850, or when Daniel Webster replied to Robert Hayne in defense of the Union against the doctrine of nullification and states' rights, Washington, D.C., ground to a halt. Everybody wanted to get a seat in the Senate to listen to these great speakers. It was both high entertainment and an education in the constitutional development of the American Republic.
Well, so in essence, and as you said, you know, today, TV, the Internet, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, how did news, or did it matter if news of their oratory skills, how did that travel fast enough in the mid-1800s to let the country, if it did, have a say in what was happening politically in Washington?
Today we overestimate the advantage we have in information technology over that time. When Daniel Webster, for example, gave a speech before the Senate, he had his notes prepared. There were transcriptionists who were sitting in the Senate. So as soon as he finished speaking, there would be a transcript. He would take the transcript and compare it to his notes, and there would be a printed version available for sale within 24, 36 hours. And it would be transported by mail, later by telegraph, all around the country. So within a week, if he spoke in Washington, within 2 or 3 days, you could get copies of the speech in New York, another day or two in Boston, in Charleston, probably a day or two afterwards. So people really did get the word about what was going on in Washington. Yes, it was best if you could be there and listen to them speak, but you could read the words within just a matter of days.
So when I alluded to Stephen Vincent Benet's story, and the fact that Webster was probably the best orator of the three of them, so the spellbinding nature of that oratory was essentially reserved for those in Washington who were listening and making decisions based on those speeches, correct?
Well, that part is true enough. If you're going to get the full effect of the emotions that Webster conveyed and that he evoked, you had to be there. On the other hand, people in those days were used to reading speeches. So just as some people are good at reading scripts of plays or screenplays, and they can imagine what's going on when the actors are saying these words. Likewise, if you knew the kind of speaker that Daniel Webster was, you could read his words and you could imagine what he was saying, what he would look like, what his gestures would consist of.
Well, you call him in the subtitle of your book the second generation of American giants. And as I said, they're all born around the Revolution. They all serve presidents or vice presidents who were around at the Revolution. So what was it about this, if I call it second revolution, that was so important and then seemingly led to a great war?
When Benjamin Franklin walked out of the Constitutional Convention of 1787 and walked down the streets of Philadelphia toward his house, he was stopped by a woman, a neighbor who knew him. The Constitutional Convention had been held in secret. And so she didn't know, Philadelphia didn't know what had been going on. And she said, "Dr. Franklin, what have you given us?" And he said, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." So Franklin would die within just a couple of years. And the responsibility for preserving and extending the republic would rest with the next generation of leaders. Clay, Webster, and Calhoun were preeminent among that next generation. And they had to deal with the legacy of independence and of the Constitution. They had to deal specifically with the two big unanswered questions unanswered by the Constitution. First, what is precisely the nature of the relationship between the central government and the states? To what extent do states have rights? To what extent do they have obligations to the federal government? In short, when push comes to shove, which level of government prevails? Is it the federal government or is it the states? The second unanswered question was, can slavery be tolerated within a republic based on the promise that all men are created equal? The framers of the Constitution did not answer these in the Constitutional Convention because they knew that any specific answer would blow up the convention and scuttle the prospects of the new Constitution. So they left it for the next generation. When Franklin said, "A republic, if you can keep it," that's precisely what he was talking about. And that's what Calhoun, Clay, and Webster argued about for the next 4 years.
Did these men, in essence, make the times, or did the times make these three men?
It's always a combination of the two. So it was a time that valued political oratory. Today, if there were a great public speaker, a great political speaker, his or her gifts would be lost because our political system simply doesn't require it, doesn't even make good use of it. But in those days, it did. So somebody else, if the demands on politicians were different, there would have been people with those different skill sets. But the fact is that because the ability to speak movingly, compellingly, educationally was valued, these people were able to come to the fore. And so it's always a combination of the individual and the times, and this is especially true in a democracy. When people, that is the broad public, the voting public, chooses their leader. So somebody in politics can't resist his or her time. You can't be too far ahead, you can't be too far behind, or democracy simply will ignore you.
Well, they each, well, first of all, did they each really want to be president of the United States?
They lived at a time when you could be a great man, and it was only men in politics, you could be a great man without ever becoming president. The political itch, the ambition to be one, the only president, rather than one of 60 senators, that did bite, but none of the three achieved that ambition, and yet they still were revered by their generation. They weren't considered failures. Today, if somebody tries for president, in fact, since the beginning of the 20th century, if you have political ambitions and you try for the presidency and you fail, that's what is remembered about you. You cannot make a name for yourself in politics today simply by being a great senator, because it's expected that you will try to become president. If you fail, you're remembered as a failure. That was not the case. In the 19th century, Americans were still operating under the expectations of the Constitution. The Constitution places Congress in Article 1. The presidency is only in Article 2. The framers of the Constitution expected, intended, that Congress should have the initiative in American politics, and that Congress was where the big decisions would be made. The presidency was simply there to sign the legislation that Congress passed.
You know, I've always wondered, you know, we are a young country, and we've held together because of this document, which has not been replicated in the rest of the world. How do you think, and you've written so much about this, how do you think it became such a flexible document that it is still able to control in great extent the nature of what goes on? Why is it so flexible?
Well, it's so flexible, firstly, because it's so short. It is just the briefest outline of what this government should consist of and how it should operate. And the other thing is, there has been an unspoken conspiracy on the part of people in the political system to ignore the Constitution and create large institutions that are not in the Constitution, but nonetheless have become indispensable to the way we run our politics. So, for example, there is nothing in the Constitution about political parties, but political parties determine who is going to get to run for the offices that staff Congress and the presidency, and on any number of things. So the so-called originalist school of constitutional interpretation, to my way of thinking, fails on its basic merits, because the Constitution is silent on about 80% of what government does. I mean, on simple things like the Constitution says that Congress can coin money. Can it print paper money? Well, we've concluded the answer is yes, but the framers of the Constitution did not have that in mind. The president is commander-in-chief, or Congress can raise an army. Can it raise an air force? Well, obviously, there were no air forces back then. So, in fact, the Constitution has just been the starting point, and we've filled in around it. We've filled in a whole lot more than the Constitution ever had in mind, but it's more of a constitutional culture that we have than the Constitution itself that is responsible for the way things have turned out.
It's a different way of, for some reason, it's the reverence that I have for the document that seems to give me my opinion that it actually controls more than you say it does. I never really thought about it that way, the way you just described it. But going back to the three great men and my idea about the times making the man, what about, like, if you say, what about this, the concept, were these guys like Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin, like the cult of personality, that they controlled in some sense what was going to happen in our country?
Well, they certainly did. And so when Daniel Webster and Henry Clay and John Calhoun argued about the Compromise of 1850, this is the most critical compromise in the history of the United States. Calhoun opposed but Clay and Webster were in favor. It was Clay's blueprint, this eight-part package, that was going to resolve the question of what to do about California now that it is suddenly filled with population and they want to enter the Union as a free state. What does the South get in response? So this was something that was cooked up entirely in Congress. And it was hammered out in Congress, and then it was finally handed to the president. Cult of personality, well, you can't achieve that when you are one of a body, when you're one of a part of the Senate. If you're the single leader of a government, if you're a Stalin, if you're a Churchill, if you're a Franklin Roosevelt, then there's more of that. But they certainly were the celebrities, the rock stars of their era. People knew, and people still know, about Henry Clay when they have a hard time remembering who Millard Fillmore was or Franklin Pierce. The great members of Congress were bigger in the national mind than all but two or three presidents in the 19th century.
It's funny, the way you describe all these things, it doesn't sound that much different, maybe a standard or half a standard deviation away from what's going on today in our society, in our political society.
Well, there was a big difference in that today we expect that legislation, foreign policy, politics generally in the national government will be initiated and driven by the president. And so nowadays Congress waits for the White House to send up its budget, and then it fiddles around with it and passes it or revises it or something. In those days, Congress wrote the budget itself. Congress decided how we're going to resolve these critical issues. Shall Missouri be admitted as a slave state, as a free state? What will happen to the rest of the Louisiana Purchase? These big decisions were made. They were begun. They were thrashed out in Congress rather than simply in response to something that the White House initiates, as has been the case since the beginning of the 20th century.
Well, since it's kind of like topsy-turvy then, how did the presidents in power during the tenure of these three great men, how did those presidents respond, or did they? Or did they join one or another?
They mostly responded. So Andrew Jackson, who was president during 8 years at this time, he pretty much waited around for Congress to make decisions on big issues, and then he would either sign the legislation they sent him. In a few high-profile cases, he vetoed it. But he didn't tell members of Congress, this is what I want you to do. It was really a matter of the president's response. And this was the way the Constitution designed that it would be. And so it's really not until the beginning of the 20th century that in American politics at the national level we have a president-led system. Through the 19th century, and definitely in the first half of the 19th century, the era of these three guys, it was Congress that took the lead.
It's not fair or proper semantically to frame this question this way, but would you say one or two or all three of these men were responsible in part for the Civil War?
No. In fact, I would put that burden on their successors. I would say that this generation was responsible for holding the country together at three particular moments when it could have fallen apart. And Henry Clay was the moving spirit behind each of these three great compromises. In his age, he was known as the great compromiser, and that was a compliment in those days. Today, it wouldn't be quite such a compliment. The Missouri Compromise of 1820 settled this question of what's going to happen about slavery in the Louisiana Purchase. And that was a moment when the country could have fallen apart. 13 years later, when South Carolina threatened to leave the Union over a tariff that it didn't like, once again, Henry Clay organized a compromise. In this case, he was assisted by John Calhoun, who was the leader of the South Carolinians and the one who was protesting most mightily against the tariff. And finally, in 1850, when it looked as though the question of slavery in the Western Territories might once again break up the Union, the Compromise of 1850 held things together. Henry Clay was a firm believer in the value of compromise. He believed that it was necessary to acknowledge the legitimacy of your opponent's positions. You must not treat your opponent as your enemy. You must not try to gain everything at every moment in time. He believed that if the country could simply muddle through for another 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, then its problems would tend to resolve themselves. Clay was a firm believer that slavery would become anachronistic in the South if the Union could simply hold together for another 20, maybe 30 years. The Compromise of 1820, the Missouri Compromise, had lasted for 30 years by the time of the Compromise of 1850. Clay was thinking another 30 years and the slavery issue will have simply disappeared. Well, he died, Calhoun died, Webster died, and the country wasn't given those 30 years. The next generation was the generation that lost the spirit of compromise. They wanted to push things to a head right away. And within 8 years of the demise of Clay and Webster, the country was at civil war.
Well, although it's outside the confines of your book, who were those successors?
One of the successors was Stephen Douglas, who was a senator from Illinois, a Democrat. There were numerous successors in South Carolina of John Calhoun, who took the spirit of Calhoun and said, okay, we've had enough of compromise. We believe that our interest, specifically our interest in owning slaves, is endangered by the rise of this new party, the Republican Party, which was dedicated to opposing slavery. And when Abraham Lincoln, the first Republican president, was elected, they and others, other states, decided to test the boundaries of states' rights and seceded from the Union. So for them, the value of the Union wasn't sufficient to keep them in. They felt that it was more important to preserve the rights of the states rather than to preserve the Union.
Well, then these successors, specifically the Southern successors, who followed the ideals of Calhoun with regard to what slavery was, did they look upon slavery at that point as this type of benevolent situation in which they were doing the best that they could for what they considered an inferior race, or did they really look upon it as a plantation society in which slavery was simply one of the perks? How did they look at it? How did
they looked at it, first of all, as essential to the economic success of the South. They could not imagine, and nobody could figure out, how to run cotton plantations in the Gulf Coast Delta without slaves. So that was part of it. Secondly, slavery was the principal form of capital investment in the United States, not simply in the South. There was more money invested in slaves than in all of the real estate in the United States. It was a method of racial and social control. So in all of these, slavery was essential to the way slaveholders and the ruling opinion in the South conceived of their notion of what the South is going to be like. But should slavery have lasted somewhat longer, and I certainly can't prove this, I'm just going to put this out for consideration. Slavery had been ended in the North, not because Northerners were more moral than Southerners, but because slavery had ceased to make economic sense in the North. At one time, it had made economic sense, but the North was further along the track of industrial development. And industrial economies need flexible workforces, and slavery is utterly inflexible. You can't lay off slaves. You have to feed them, house them, and so on. And people like Henry Clay believed that industrialization would come to the South as well, and the South would conclude exactly what the North had concluded some decades before, that slavery no longer makes economic sense. So after slavery stopped making economic sense, then Southern slaveholders would no longer feel obliged to make arguments about the philanthropy that they contended was involved in their operation of the slave system.
It's funny, when I lived in the South for 20 years or so, it was amazing to me to still see the remnants of the same position that the war was considered and told to me many times as the war of Northern aggression. And it's just incredible to me that this much time has passed and yet a good portion of the people I knew there felt that way.
Well, people who lived through it in the South certainly felt that way. Their position was that states have the right to leave the Union. They believed that it was their constitutional right to leave the Union. And if indeed it was their constitutional right, as they thought, then for Abraham Lincoln and the government of the northern states to forcibly prevent them from doing that, from their perspective, indeed, it was a war of northern aggression. Lincoln, of course, saw it differently. He said that states do not have a right to leave the Union. They are simply refusing to obey and enforce federal laws, and they must be forced into line. So if you were one of the secessionists in 1860 and 1861, or for that matter, if you were a grandchild of one of them, it would make perfect intellectual sense to call it a war of northern aggression. So I'm not surprised that you ran across that. And the question of, did the southern states have the constitutional right to secede, is one that can still be argued on its merits. The Constitution is silent. The Constitution doesn't say you can't leave the Union. It doesn't say you can leave the Union. The reason it's silent is that the framers of the Constitution knew if they wrote it down, it would have blown up the Constitutional Convention, and the Constitution never would have been ratified.
Because of Virginia, right?
Well, it wasn't just Virginia. It was the other southern states as well. Virginia was key, but the Carolinas and Georgia, Maryland, they wanted to make sure that those states were in the Union.
I mean, the book lays this out clearly, but it's still interesting and feels wrong to me, because in going to school from elementary school to high school to college, your textbooks and your professors tell you that it's a moral dichotomy, that slavery or not is definitely a moral dichotomy. It's not good men versus bad men, a good system versus a bad system, but it's grounded in good and evil. And what you're saying is, while that may be a small portion of it, the driving force behind the division in the country and eventually the war is simply economics.
No, it wasn't simply economic. In fact, one of the things that I've inferred from history that I've studied is, in history, it's never simply something. Things are always complicated. Henry Clay is a good example of this complication. He was a slaveholder, but he was also an emancipationist. He thought slavery was a bad institution, bad for the slaves, bad for the slave owners, bad for his state of Kentucky, bad for the United States. And he worked his whole life politically to try to end the institution of slavery. But he still held on to his slaves. Does that mean he's a hypocrite? Well, no, actually, because Henry Clay understood that freeing his 40 or 50 slaves would be a drop in the bucket against against the millions of slaves still held. But if he held on to his slaves and he argued against slavery as a slaveholder, he would have much greater credibility than if he had given up his slaves. Then he would simply sound like all those other abolitionists who would point the finger of moral blame at the slaveholders and say, "You are evil." And the reason this upset the South is most of the people who owned slaves did not consider themselves evil. They considered themselves to be doing the best they could under the circumstances. Their position was, we didn't create this institution. We inherited this institution. And until we can make the institution go away, we've got to manage the institution. So it was a complicated issue. And people who want to explain the Civil War as either a case of states' rights or of slavery, they're trying to oversimplify. Both elements were essential in creating the division that gave rise to the Civil War.
Well, I've practiced law for well over 30 years, and I've always, perhaps wrongfully, prided myself on being able to hold two competing ideas in my head at the same time. And so that brings me to Daniel Webster, which I can imagine him in the courtroom switching tables and going from one side to the other and being equally persuasive. And so he switched his position with regard to slavery, I'm assuming, in an attempt to achieve...
No, actually he didn't switch his position. He disappointed his constituents who had switched their position. So Daniel Webster, after some early flirtation with the concept of states' rights and whether states should be able to secede from the Union during the War of 1812, he became the most ardent advocate of the Union. Now, he thought that slavery was a bad deal, but he was by no means an abolitionist, and he put a higher priority on preserving the Union than on abolishing slavery. His Massachusetts constituents originally did too, But by 1850, the abolitionist element in Massachusetts had gained sufficient strength that they wanted Webster to take a strong stand against slavery, even if it broke up the Union. And Webster wouldn't go that far. He would say the Union is more important than freeing the slaves. And his thinking was, if the Union holds together, the slaves will be freed, and men will be free. But if the Union breaks apart, there's no telling what will happen to the slaves. After all, if the Union breaks apart, the South will take its slaves and will have no hold over them. So Webster and Clay believed that holding the Union together afforded the greatest promise for the greatest good for the greatest number of people, even including the slaves. There were some Northern abolitionists, including some who lived in Massachusetts, who wanted the North to secede from the South so that the North could simply wash its hands of slavery. But Clay and Webster understood, well, that's not going to do the slaves any good. If anything, it's going to make their lot worse.
It's funny because it seems as if Clay's and Webster's position was pragmatic and clinical to a certain extent, but it also seems, and from your book, it kind of seems, that Calhoun's position was one based on a true belief that slavery was the keystone of the South and that it was the right thing to do.
Calhoun was driven to that position partly because his ambitions for national office faded away and his opposition to Andrew Jackson. John Calhoun, by the early 1830s, realized he was never going to be president of the United States. He would never be a national leader. At best, he could be a regional leader. That was part of it. Another part was an understandable human reaction in John Calhoun and many people in the South, slaveholders in the South, against the diatribes of abolitionists in the North, who said that these people are not simply wrong, these slaveholders, but they're sinful, they're immoral. And John Calhoun looked at himself and said, I'm not immoral. I believe in God. I'm doing the best I can by my life. I'm good to my slaves. And, you know, so don't you tell me that I'm more sinful than you. And so his reaction to that was, I think he might even have admitted that he overreacted, but he declared slavery is a positive good. And this is the thing that's usually remembered against John Calhoun, and it's an utterly unsustainable position today. But it's not impossible to understand how that position came about.
Explain that to me.
Okay, so if you're doing something, I don't know what your habits are, but if you're doing something that you think is necessary for your own welfare and the welfare of your family and the people around you, and I decide that it's immoral and sinful, and I keep yelling at you and saying, that's immoral, Sam, that's sinful, you got to stop doing it, you're going to go to hell. Well, your reaction to this is going to be, that's not true. And you're probably going to say, you're going to defend yourself. And that's essentially what Calhoun was doing. And he wasn't alone, because there were plenty of slaveholders who considered themselves to be rather kind masters. Now, we live at a time when kind master is considered essentially an oxymoron. If you're a master, you're not kind. But, as I say, the people, many of them inherited their slaves. They couldn't figure out any other way to run the Southern economy. And they looked around and said, there's lots of evils in the world. War is an evil. And yet, even today, we tolerate war. We tolerate the fact that innocent civilians get killed as collateral damage in war. And we don't consider ourselves horrible people for doing that. We acknowledge that there are some evils in the world. And some of the slaveholders acknowledge this is one of the evils in the world. And maybe one day we'll be able to get past it, but we haven't gotten past it yet. Just as we today haven't figured, at least in the United States, we have not figured out how to get beyond the use of war.
Since you're talking about today, even though it's outside the ambit of your book, but you are talking about it, do you find that the divisiveness that is increasing on a weekly, if not daily, basis in our country, do you find that there are any parallels in the slightest?
Yeah, I do. I find some parallels, actually, between today and the period at the end of the lives of Webster, Clay, and Calhoun, and in the decade after. In those days, The polarization, the big divide, was between North and South. It was sectional. Today it's partisan. But what I see and what I'm somewhat alarmed about is the fact that there is this growing belief that my political opponent is my enemy, and that I need to grab everything that I can, and we need to destroy the other party. That the other party is, these are evil people. We cannot talk to them. We cannot compromise with them. They have no right to their positions. This is exactly the kind of language, the kind of thinking that gave rise to the Civil War. I'm not saying there's going to be a civil war. Too many other things would have to happen. But still, there is that polarization. We have pretty much lost, or at least we're losing, the spirit of compromise that allowed people like Clay and Webster to hold the Union together against those divisive forces for 30 years. Now, eventually they died, and with them died the spirit of compromise. But I would really like to see somebody try to resurrect this spirit of compromise, because that's the only thing that will keep a democracy going. If a democracy becomes a zero-sum game where a win for one side is a loss for the other side, then democracies won't last forever. Clay's generation understood that democracy is fragile, and they had to work to make it work. We have been lulled by the fact that our democracy is still going after 200 years to think it'll go forever. But I don't think we can take that as guaranteed by any means.
Do you think that the spirit of compromise is in any way diminished due to what is now a lack of civility? I mean, back then, you would take a break from war to have tea, or you would agree to have a truce, and you would actually have a truce, or you would have a duel in which the rules were set, you abided by them, and there doesn't seem to be much like that today. There doesn't seem to be much civility.
That part's true enough, but I would point out that, in fact, we haven't had any duels in Washington lately. So the nastiness is largely confined to the spoken word or the written word or the tweeted word or something like that. There isn't physical violence the way there was in the first half of the 19th century. So things are improved in that regard.
If things had been different, and I don't like to talk about it in terms of of an alternate history, but if things had gone differently and the Union had sundered, and that's kind of a stupid question, but if the Union had sundered, what do you think it would have looked like maybe 10 or 20 years after that? What do you think?
If the Union had fallen apart?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's entirely likely that there would have been a war between the two independent countries. And it could very well have been over a simple issue, and that is the issue of escaped slaves. So the big deal, one of the reasons the South was so upset against the North, is that when a slave escaped from slave Kentucky across the Ohio River into free Ohio, people in Ohio were not cooperating in the return of that fugitive slave. And the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 basically required them to do so. But if these had been two separate countries, then we'll call it the Northern United States would have felt no obligation whatsoever to help. And there would have been a massive outflow of slaves from the South to the North, because you didn't have to get all the way to Canada to be finally free. You'd simply get to the North and you'd be free. And the South would have issued an ultimatum to the North: you have to prevent those people from escaping. And the North would have said, forget it. And quite likely there would have been a war as a result of that.
Yeah, it is fascinating to think about, and I wonder what would have happened, but it does go far afield from your book. So in the time we have remaining, I guess, is there a legacy that you can see, and you discuss it a bit in your book, is there a legacy that you can see that carries on to this time from each of these three men?
I wouldn't say separately, but I would say that the lesson of their generation is that democracy requires tending, and tending democracy requires the ability to compromise, to accept the legitimacy of your opponent's position, and to acknowledge that. They have a right to their opinions, they have a right to the seat at the table. And the larger goal of any political group has to be to preserve the institutions that have gotten us through these 200-plus years. because unless we pay attention to them, unless we cultivate them, they might well disappear or disintegrate entirely.
Okay, well, let's leave it there. Thank you so much, Dr. Brands, for explaining all of this, and a lot of it's new insight for me. And I didn't mention that I own an independent bookstore, and since yesterday, your book has been there on the front shelf and doing very well. So
fantastic.
Good to hear. I really do appreciate it. And look forward, since I know you'll be writing several more books, look forward to talking to you again.
Okay, good enough. Thank you.
Bye-bye. That was Dr. H.W. Brands discussing his book, one of his 25 books, Heirs of the Founders. Well, subtitle, Heirs of the Founders, The Epic Rivalry of Henry Clay, John Calhoun, and Daniel Webster, the Second Generation of American Giants, which may sound dry at first, but when you begin reading about it, as many of the reviews say, it's just a very accessible book that maybe he didn't sound like it, but I found a lot of fun as well. And it's also, and as you could tell from my responses to many of my questions, it gives you new insights as to why we are where we are today, the parallels, and how these three men help shape their generation and succeeding generations to come. So, we have coming up Kara Cooney. She's a famous Egyptologist who also is a lot of fun, has appeared on the Craig Ferguson Show 8 times. But her book is fascinating. It's called When Women Ruled the World, 6 Queens of Egypt, and discusses how, through circumstance, through the death of men, and through expediency, there were many times in Egypt where the king was actually a woman. She talks about that in length, comparing each of those 6 women, and also discusses it in terms of where we stand today with regard to our treatment of women and where they stand with regard to status in our culture. And then I think I'm going to rebroadcast, only because it's so popular, the book There, There by Tommy Orange, which was long listed for the National Book Award and is still on the bestseller list after, I don't know, before I interviewed him. No, I interviewed him before it got popular. So it's been on the bestseller list for at least 20 weeks. And that's why I'm going to rebroadcast it. So as always, thanks so much for joining us today. And I look forward to having you here next week, as always, on The Avid Reader.